In his, her place is a woman whose neck is immobilized in one of those collar things. As for me, I'm off my ventilator now. I remember the social worker telling my grandparents and Aunt Diane that this was a positive step. I stopped to check if I feel any different, but I don't feel anything, not physically anyhow. I haven't since I was in the car this morning, listening to Beethoven's Cello Sonata No. 3. Now that I'm breathing on my own, my wall of machines bleeps far less, so I get fewer visits from the nurses. Nurse Ramirez, the one with the nails, looks over at me every now and again, but she's busy with the new guy with the half-face.
"Holy crud! Is that Brooke Vega?"
I hear someone ask in a totally fakey, dramatic voice from outside the ICU's automatic doors. I've never heard any of Adam's friends talk so PG-13 before. It's their sanitized hospital version of holy fucking shit.
"You mean Brooke Vega of Bikini? Brooke Vega, who was on the cover of Spin magazine last month? Here, in this very hospital?"
This time it's Kim talking. She sounds like a 6-year-old reciting lines from a school play about the food groups. "You mean you're supposed to eat 5 servings of fruit and vegetables a day?"
"Yeah, that's right," says Brooke's raspy voice. "I'm here to offer some rock and roll sucker to all the people of Portland."
A couple of the younger nurses, the ones who probably listen to pop radio or watch MTV and have heard of Bikini, look up, their faces excited question marks. I hear them whispering, eager to see if it's really Brooke, or maybe just happy for the break in the routine.
"Yeah, that's right. So I thought I might sing a little song. One of my favorites. It's called Eraser," Brooke says. "One of you guys want to count me in?"
"I need something to tap with," Liz answers. "Anyone got some pens or something?"
Now the nurses and orderlies in the ICU are very curious and heading toward the doors. I'm watching it all play out like a movie on the screen. I stand next to my bed, my eyes trained on the double doors, waiting for them to open. I'm itching with suspense. I think of Adam, of how calming it feels when he touches me, how when he absent-mindedly strokes the nape of my neck or blows warm air on my cold hands, I could melt into a puddle.
"What's going on?"
the older nurse demands. Suddenly, every nurse on the floor is looking at her, not out toward Brooke anymore. No one is going to try to explain to her that a famous pop star is outside. The moment is broken. I feel the tension ease into disappointment. The door isn't going to open. Outside, I hear Brooke start belting out the lyrics to Eraser. Even a cappella, even through the automatic double doors, she sounds good.
"Somebody call security now," the nurse growls.
"Adam, you better just go for it," Liz yells. "Now or never. Full court press."
"Go!"
screams Kim, suddenly an army general.
"We'll cover you!"
The door opens. In a tumble, more than a half dozen punkers, Adam, Liz, Fitzy, some people I don't know, and then Kim. Outside, Brooke is still singing as though this were the concert she'd come to Portland to give. As Adam and Kim charge through the door, they both look determined, happy even. I'm amazed by their resilience, by their hidden pockets of strength. I want to jump up and down and root for them like I used to do at Teddy's T-ball games when he'd be rounding third and heading for home. It's hard to believe, but watching Kim and Adam in action, I almost feel happy, too.
"Where is she?" Adam yells. "Where's Mia?"
"In the corner, next to the supply closet,"
someone shouts. It takes me a minute to realize it's Nurse Ramirez.
"Security! Get him! Get him!"
the grumpy nurse shouts. She has spotted Adam through all the other invaders, and her face has gone pink with anger. 2 hospital security guards and 2 orderlies run inside.
"Dude, was that Brooke Vega?"
one asks as he snags Fitzy and flings him toward the exit.
"Think so,"
the other answers, grabbing Sarah and steering her out. Kim has spotted me.
"Adam, she's here!"
she screams, and then turns to look at me, the scream dying in her throat.
"She's here," she says again, only this time it's a whimper. Adam hears her, and he's dodging nurses and making his way to me. And then he's there at the foot of my bed, his hand reaching out to touch me, his hand about to be on me. Suddenly, I think of our first kiss after the Yo-Yo Ma concert, how I didn't know how badly I wanted his lips on mine until the kiss was imminent. I didn't realize just how much I was craving his touch until now that I can almost feel it on me. Almost. But suddenly he's moving away from me. Two guards have him by the shoulders and have yanked him back. One of the same guards grabs Kim's elbow and leads her out. She's limp now, offering no resistance. Brooke's still singing in the hallway. When she sees Adam, she stops. "Sorry, honey," she says. "I gotta jet before I miss my show. Or get arrested." And then she's off down the hall, trailed by a couple of orderlies begging for her autograph.
"Call the police," the old nurse yells. "Have him arrested."
"We're taking him down to security. That's protocol," one guard says.
"Not up to us to arrest," the other adds. "Just get him off my ward,"
she harumphs and turns around.
"Ms. Ramirez, that had better not have been you abetting those hoodlums."
"Of course not. I was in the supply closet. I missed all the hubbub," she replies. She's such a good liar that her face gives nothing away. The old nurse claps her hands.
"Okay, show's over. Back to work."
I chase after Adam and Kim, who are being led into the elevators. I jump in with them. Kim looks dazed, like someone flipped her reset button and she's still booting up. Adam's lips are set in a grim line. I can't tell if he's about to cry or about to punch the guard. For his sake, I hope it's the former. For my own, I hope the latter. Downstairs, the guards hustle Adam and Kim toward a hallway filled with darkened offices. They're about to go inside one of the few offices with lights on when I hear someone scream Adam's name.
"Adam? Stop, is that you?"
"Willow?" Adam yells. "Willow?" Kim mumbles.
"Excuse me, where are you taking them?" Willow yells at the guards as she runs toward them.
"I'm sorry, but these two were caught trying to break into the ICU," one guard explains.
"Only because they wouldn't let us in,"
Kim explains weakly. Willow catches up to them. She's still wearing her nursing clothes, which is strange because she normally changes out of what she calls orthopedic couture as soon as she can. Her long, curly auburn hair looks lank and greasy, like she's forgotten to wash it these past few weeks. And her cheeks, normally rosy like apples, have been repainted beige.
"Excuse me, I'm an RN over at Cedar Creek. I did my training here, so if you like, we can go straighten this out with Richard Caruthers."
"Who's he?"
one guard asks.
"Director of Community Affairs,"
the other replies. Then he turns to Willow.
"He's not here. It's not business hours."
"Well, I have his home number," Willow says, brandishing her cell phone like a weapon.
"I doubt he'd be pleased if I were to call him now and tell him how his hospital was treating someone trying to visit his critically wounded girlfriend. You know that the director values compassion as much as efficiency, and this is not the way to treat a concerned loved one."
"We're just doing our job, ma'am, following orders."
"How about I save you two the trouble and take it from here? The patient's family is all assembled upstairs. They're waiting for these two to join them. Here, if you have any problems, you tell Mr. Caruthers to get in touch with me."
She reaches into her bag and pulls out a card and hands it over. One of the guards looks at it, hands it to the other, who stares at it and shrugs.
"Might as well save ourselves the paperwork," he says.
He lets go of Adam, whose body slumps like a scarecrow taken off his pole.
"Sorry, kid,"
he says to Adam, brushing off his shoulders.
"I hope your girlfriend's okay,"
the other mumbles, and then they disappear toward the glow of some vending machines. Kim, who has met Willow all of twice, flings herself into her arms.
"Thank you,"
she murmurs into her neck. Willow hugs her back, pats her on the shoulders before letting go. She rubs her eyes and winces out a brittle laugh.
"What in the hell were you two thinking?" she asks.
"I want to see Mia," Adam says. Willow turns to look at Adam, and it's like someone has unscrewed her valve, letting all her air escape. She deflates. She reaches out and touches Adam's cheek. "Of course you do." She wipes her eyes with the heel of her hand.
"Are you okay?"
Kim asks. Willow ignores the question. Let's see about getting you into Mia. Adam perks up when he hears this. You think you can? That old nurse has it in for me. If that old nurse is who I think she is, it doesn't matter if she has it in for you. It's not up to her. Let's check in with Mia's grandparents, and then I'll find out who's in charge of breaking the rules around here, and get you in to see your girl. She needs you now. More than ever. Adam swivels around and hugs Willow with such force that her feet lift up off the ground. Willow to the rescue. Just the way she rescued Henry, Dad's best friend and bandmate, who, once upon a time, was a total drunk playboy. When he and Willow had been dating a few weeks, she told him to straighten out and dry out or say goodbye. Dad said that lots of girls had given Henry ultimatums, tried to force him to settle down, and lots of girls had been left crying on the sidewalk. But when Willow packed her toothbrush and told Henry to grow up, Henry was the one who cried. Then he dried his tears, grew up, got sober and monogamous. 8 years later, here they are, with a baby, no less. Willow is formidable that way. Probably why after she and Henry got together, she became Mom's best friend. She was another tough-as-nails, tender-as-kittens, feminist bitch. And probably why she was one of Dad's favorite people, even though she hated the Ramones and thought baseball was boring, while Dad lived for the Ramones and thought baseball was a religious institution. Now Willow is here. Willow the nurse. Willow, who doesn't take no for an answer, is here. She'll get Adam in to see me. She'll take care of everything. Hooray! I want to shout, Willow is here! I'm so busy celebrating Willow's arrival that the implication of her being here takes a few moments to sink in. But when it does, it hits me like a jolt of electricity. Willow is here. And if she's here, if she's in my hospital, it means that there isn't any reason for her to be in her hospital. I know her well enough to know that she would never have left him there. Even with me here, she would have stayed with him. He was broken and brought to her for fixing. He was her patient, her priority. I think about the fact that Gran and Gramps are in Portland with me, and that all anyone in that waiting room is talking about is me. How they are avoiding mentioning Mom or Dad or Teddy. I think about Willow's face, which looks like it has been scrubbed clean of all joy. And then I think about what she told Adam, that I need him now, more than ever. And that's how I know. Teddy. He's gone too. Mom went into labor 3 days before Christmas, and she insisted we go holiday shopping together. Shouldn't you like to lie down or go to the birthing center or something? I asked. Mom grimaced through a cramp. Nah, the contractions aren't that bad and are still like 20 minutes apart. I cleaned our entire house from top to bottom while I was in early labor with you. Putting the labor in labor, I joked. You're a smartass, you know that? Mom said. She took a few breaths. I've got a ways to go. Now come on, let's take the bus to the mall. I'm not up to driving. Shouldn't we call Dad? I asked. Mom laughed at that. Please. It's enough for me to have to birth this baby. I don't need to deal with him, too. We'll call him when I'm ready to pop. I'd much rather have you around. So Mom and I wandered around the mall, stopping every couple of minutes so she could sit down and take deep breaths and squeeze my wrist so hard it left angry red marks. Still, it was a weirdly fun and productive morning. We bought presents for Gran and Gramps, a sweater with an angel on it and a new book about Abraham Lincoln, and toys for the baby, and a new pair of rain boots for me. Usually we waited for the holiday sales to buy stuff like that, but Mom said that this year we'd be too busy changing diapers. Now's not the time to be cheap. Ow, fuck! Sorry, Mia. Come on, let's go get pie. We went to Marie Callender's. Mom had a slice of pumpkin and of banana cream. I had blueberry. When she was done, she pushed her plate away and announced she was ready to go to the midwife. We'd never really talked about my being there or not being there. I went everywhere with Mom and Dad at that point, so it was just kind of assumed.
We met a nerve-wracked dad at the birthing center, which was nothing like a doctor's office. It was the ground floor of a house, the inside decked out with beds and jacuzzi tubs, the medical equipment discreetly tucked away. The hippie midwife led Mom inside, and Dad asked me if I wanted to come, too. By now, I could hear Mom screaming profanities. "I can call Gran, and she'll pick you up," Dad said, wincing at Mom's barrage. "This might take a while." I shook my head. Mom needed me. She'd said so. I sat down on one of the floral couches and picked up a magazine with a goofy-looking bald baby on the cover. Dad disappeared into the room with the bed.
"Music! God damn it, music!" Mom screamed. "We have some lovely Enya, very soothing," the midwife said.
"Fuck Enya!" Mom screamed. "Melvin's, Earth, now!" "I've got it covered," Dad said. Then he popped a CD of the loudest, churningest, guitar-heaviest music I'd ever heard. It made all the fast-paced punk songs Dad normally listened to sound like harp music. This music was primal, and that seemed to make Mom feel better. She started making these low, guttural noises. I just sat there quietly. Every so often, she'd scream my name, and I'd scamper inside. Mom would look up at me, her face plastered with sweat.
"Don't be scared," she'd whisper. "Women can handle the worst kind of pain. You'll find out one day."
Then she'd scream fuck again.
I'd seen a couple of birds on that cable TV show, and people usually yelled for a while. Sometimes they swore and it had to be bleeped, but it never took longer than half an hour. After 3 hours, Mom and the Melvins were still screaming along. The whole birthing center felt tropically humid, even though it was 40 degrees outside. Henry dropped by. When he came inside and heard the noise, he froze in his tracks. I knew that the whole kid thing freaked him out. I'd overheard Mom and Dad talking about that and Henry's refusal to grow up. He'd apparently been shocked when Mom and Dad had me, and now was completely bewildered that they chose to have a second. They'd both been relieved when he and Willow had gotten back together. "Finally, a grown-up in Henry's life," Mom had said. Henry looked at me. His face was pale and sweaty.
"Holy shit, me. Should you be hearing this? Should I be hearing this?"
I shrugged. Henry sat down next to me.
"I've got the flu or something, but your dad just called asking me to bring some food. So here I am," he said,
proffering a Taco Bell bag reeking of onions. Mom let out another moan.
"I should go. Don't want me spreading germs or anything."
Mom screamed even louder, and Henry practically jumped in his seat.
"You sure you want to hang around for this? You can come back to my place. Willow's there, taking care of me."
He grinned when he mentioned her name.
"She can take care of you, too."
He stood up to leave. "No, I'm fine. Mom needs me. Dad's kind of freaking out, though."
"Did he puke yet?" Henry asked, sitting back down on the couch.
I laughed, but then saw from his face that he was serious.
"He threw up when you were coming, almost fainted on the floor. Not that I can blame him, but the dude was a mess. The doctors wanted to kick him out. Said they were going to if you didn't come out within a half hour. That got your mom so pissed off she pushed you out 5 minutes later."
Henry smiled, leaning back into the sofa.
"So the story goes. But I'll tell you this. He cried like a motherfucking baby when you were born."
"I've heard that part."
"Heard what part?"
Dad asked breathlessly. He grabbed the bag from Henry.
"Taco Bell, Henry?" "Dinner of champions," Henry said. "It'll do. I'm starving. It's intense in there. Gotta keep up my strength."
Henry winked at me. Dad pulled out a burrito and offered one to me. I shook my head. Dad had started unwrapping his meal when Mom let out a growl and then started screaming at the midwife that she was ready to push. The midwife poked her head out the door.
"I think we're getting close, so maybe you should save dinner for later," she said. "Come on back."
Henry practically bolted out the front door. I followed Dad into the bedroom where Mom was sitting now, panting like a sick dog.
"Would you like to watch?"
the midwife asked Dad, but he just swayed and turned a pale shade of green. "I'm probably better up here," he said, grasping Mom's hand, which she violently shook off. No one asked me if I wanted to watch.
I just automatically went to stand next to the midwife. It was pretty gross, I'll admit. Lots of blood. And I'd certainly never seen my mom so full-on frontal before. But it felt strangely normal for me to be there. The midwife was telling Mom to push, then hold, then push.
"Go, baby, go, baby, go, baby, go," she chanted. "You're almost there," she cheered.
Mom looked like she wanted to smack her. When Teddy slid out, he was head up, facing the ceiling, so that the first thing he saw was me. He didn't come out squalling like you see on TV. He was just quiet. His eyes were open, staring straight at me. He held my gaze as the midwife suctioned out his nose.
"It's a boy," she shouted.
The midwife put Teddy on Mom's belly.
"Do you want to cut the cord?" she asked Dad.
Dad waved his hands no, too overcome or nauseous to speak.
"I'll do it," I offered.
The midwife held the cord taut and told me where to cut. Teddy lay still, his gray eyes wide open, still staring at me. Mom always said that it was because Teddy saw me first and because I cut his cord that somewhere deep down he thought I was his mother.
"It's like those goslings," Mom joked, "imprinting on a zoologist, not the mama goose, because he was the first one they saw when they hatched."
She exaggerated. Teddy didn't really think I was his mother, but there were certain things that only I could do for him. When he was a baby and going through his nightly fussy period, he'd only calm down after I played him a lullaby on my cello. When he started getting into Harry Potter, only I was allowed to read a chapter to him every night. And when he'd skin a knee or bump his head, if I was around, he would not stop crying until I bestowed a magic kiss on the injury, after which he'd miraculously recover. I know that all the magic kisses in the world probably couldn't have helped him today. But I would do anything to have been able to give him one. 10:40 p.m. I run away. I leave Adam, Kim, and Willow in the lobby, and I just start careening through the hospital. I don't realize that I'm looking for the pediatric ward until I get there. I tear through the halls, past rooms with nervous four-year-olds sleeping restlessly before tomorrow's tonsillectomies, past the neonatal ICU with babies the size of fists hooked up to more tubes than I am, past the pediatric oncology unit where bald cancer patients sleep under cheerful murals of rainbows and balloons. I'm looking for him. Even though I know I won't find him, still I have to keep looking. I picture his head, his tight blonde curls. I love to nuzzle my face in those curls, have done since he was a baby. I kept waiting for the day when he'd swap me away, say, "You're embarrassing me," the way he does to Dad when Dad cheers too loudly at t-ball games. But so far that hadn't happened. So far I've been allowed constant access to that head of his. So far? Now there is no more so far. It's over. I picture myself nuzzling his head one last time, and I can't even imagine it without seeing myself crying, my tears turning his blonde curlicues straight. Teddy is never going to graduate from t-ball to baseball. He's never going to grow a mustache, never going to get into a fistfight or shoot a deer or kiss a girl or have sex or fall in love or get married or father his own curly-haired child. I'm only 10 years older than him, but it's like I've already had so much more life. It is unfair. If one of us should have been left behind, if one of us should be given the opportunity for more life, it should be him. I race through the hospital like a trapped wild animal. "Teddy," I call, "where are you? Come back to me." But he won't. I know it's fruitless. I give up and drag myself back to my ICU. I want to break the double doors. I want to smash the nurse's station. I want it all to go away. I want to go away. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in this hospital. I don't want to be in this suspended state where I can see what's happening, where I'm aware of what I'm feeling without being able to actually feel it.
I cannot scream until my throat hurts, or break a window with my fist until my hand bleeds, or pull my hair out in clumps until the pain in my scalp overcomes the one in my heart. I'm staring at myself, at the live Mia now, lying in her hospital bed. I feel a burst of fury. If I could slap my own lifeless face, I would. Instead, I sit down in the chair and close my eyes, wishing it all away. Except I can't. I can't concentrate because there's suddenly so much noise. My monitors are blipping and chirping, and two nurses are racing toward me.
Her BP and pulse ox are dropping, one yells.
She's tachycardic, the other yells. What happened?
Code blue and trauma,
blares the PA. Soon the nurses are joined by a bleary-eyed doctor, rubbing the sleep out of his eyes, which are ringed by deep circles. He yanks down the covers and lifts my hospital gown. I'm naked from the waist down, but no one notices these things here. He puts his hands on my belly, which is swollen and hard. His eyes widen and then narrow into slits.
Abdomen's rigid, he says angrily. We need to do an ultrasound.
Nurse Ramirez runs to a back room and then wheels out what looks like a portable laptop with a long white attachment. She squirts some jelly on my stomach, and the doctor runs the attachment over my stomach.
Damn, full of fluid, he says. Patient had surgery this afternoon?
A splenectomy, Nurse Ramirez replies.
Could be a missed blood vessel that wasn't cauterized, the doctor says. Or a slow leak from a perforated bowel. Car accident, right?
Yes. Patient was medevaced in this morning. The doctor flips through my chart.
Dr. Sorensen was her surgeon. He's still on call. Page him. Get her to the OR. We need to get inside and find out what's leaking and why before she drops any further. Jesus, brain contusions, collapsed lung. This kid's a train wreck.
Nurse Ramirez shoots the doctor a dirty look, as if he had just insulted me.
Ms. Ramirez?
The grumpy nurse at the desk scolds.
You have patients of your own to deal with. Let's get this young woman intubated and transferred to the OR. That will do her more good than all this dilly-dallying around.
The nurses work rapidly to detach the monitors and catheters and run another tube down my throat. A pair of orderlies rush in with a gurney and heave me onto it. I'm still naked from the waist down as they hustle me out, but right before I reach the back door, Nurse Ramirez calls,
"Wait!"
and then gently closes the hospital gown around my legs. She taps me 3 times in the forehead with her fingers, like it's some kind of Morse code message. And then I'm gone into the maze of hallways leading toward the OR for another round of cutting. But this time I don't follow myself. This time I stay behind in the ICU. I am starting to get it now. I mean, I don't fully understand. It's not like I somehow commanded a blood vessel to pop open and start leaking into my stomach. It's not like I wished for another surgery. But Teddy is gone. Mom and Dad are gone. This morning I went for a drive with my family, and now I am here, as alone as I've ever been. I am 17 years old. This is not how it's supposed to be. This is not how my life is supposed to turn out. In the quiet corner of the ICU, I start to really think about the bitter things I've managed to ignore so far today. What would it be like if I stay? What would it feel like to wake up an orphan? To never smell Dad smoke a pipe. To never stand next to Mom, quietly talking as we do dishes. To never read Teddy another chapter of Harry Potter. To stay without them. I'm not sure this is a world I belong in anymore. I'm not sure that I want to wake up. I've only ever been to one funeral in my life, and it was for someone I hardly knew. I might have gone to Great-Aunt Glow's funeral after she died of acute pancreatitis, except her will was very specific about her final wishes. No traditional service, no burial in the family plot. Instead, she wanted to be cremated and have her ashes scattered in a sacred Native American ceremony somewhere in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Gran was pretty annoyed by that, by Aunt Glow in general, who Gran said was always trying to call attention to how different she was, even after she was dead. Gran ended up boycotting the ash scattering, and if she wasn't going, there was really no reason for the rest of us to.
Peter Hellman, my trombonist friend from conservatory camp, he died 2 years ago. But I didn't find out until I returned to camp and he wasn't there. Few of us had known that he'd had lymphoma. That was the funny thing about conservatory camp. You got so close with the people over the summer, but it was some unwritten rule that you didn't keep in touch during the rest of the year. We were summer friends. Anyhow, we had a memorial concert at camp in Peter's honor, but it wasn't really a funeral. Carrie Gifford was a musician in town, one of Mom and Dad's people. Unlike Dad and Henry, who, as they got older and had families, became less music performers than music connoisseurs, Carrie stayed single and stayed faithful to his first love, playing music. He was in three bands, and he earned his living doing the sound at a local club, an ideal setup because at least one of his bands seemed to play there every week, so he just had to hop up onto the stage and let someone take controls for his set, though sometimes you'd see him jumping down in the middle of a set to adjust the monitors himself. I had known Carrie when I was little and would go to shows with Mom and Dad, and then I sort of re-met him when Adam and I got together and I started going to shows again. He was at work one night, doing the sound for a Portland band called Claude, when he just keeled over on the soundboard. He was dead by the time the ambulance got there, a freak brain aneurysm. Carrie's death caused an uproar in our town. He was kind of a fixture around here, an outspoken guy with a big personality and this mass of wild white boy dreadlocks. And he was young, only 32. Everyone we knew was planning on going to his funeral, which was being held in the town where he grew up, in the mountains a couple of hours' drive away. Mom and Dad were going, of course, and so was Adam. So, even though I felt a little bit like an imposter crashing someone's death day, I decided to go along. Teddy stayed with Gran and Gramps. We caravanned to Carrie's hometown with a bunch of people, squeezing into a car with Henry and Willow, who was so pregnant the seatbelt wouldn't fit over her bump. Everyone took turns telling funny stories about Carrie. Carrie, the avowed left-winger who decided to protest the Iraq War by getting a bunch of guys to dress up in drag and go down to the local army recruiting office to enlist. Carrie, the atheist curmudgeon, who hated how commercialized Christmas had become, and so threw an annual Merry Anti-Christmas celebration at the club, where he held a contest for which band could play the most distorted versions of Christmas carols. Then he invited everyone to throw all their crappy presents into a big pile in the middle of the club. And contrary to local lore, Carrie did not burn the stuff in a bonfire. Dad told me that he donated it to St. Vincent de Paul. As everyone talked about Carrie, the mood in the car was fizzy and fun, like we were going to the circus, not a funeral. But it seemed right. It seemed true to Carrie, who was always overflowing with frenetic energy. The funeral, though, was the opposite. It was horribly depressing, and not just because it was for someone who died tragically young and for no particular reason aside from some bad arterial luck. It was held in a huge church, which seemed strange considering Carrie was an outspoken atheist, but that part I could understand. I mean, where else do you have a funeral? The problem was the service itself. It was obvious that the pastor had never even met Carrie, because when he talked about him, it was generic, about what a kind heart Carrie had, and how, even though it was sad that he was gone, he was getting his heavenly reward. And instead of having eulogies from his bandmates or the people in town who he'd spent the last 15 years with, some uncle from Boise got up and talked about teaching Carrie how to ride a bike when he was six. Like learning to ride a bike was the defining moment in Carrie's life. He concluded by reassuring us that Carrie was walking with Jesus now. I could see my mom getting red when he said that, and I started to get a little worried that she might say something. We went to church sometimes, so it's not like Mom had anything against religion, but Carrie totally did, and Mom was ferociously protective of the people she loved, so much that she took insults upon them personally. Her friends sometimes called her Mama Bear for this reason. Steam was practically blowing out of Mom's ears by the time the service ended with a rousing rendition of Bette Midler's Wind Beneath My Wings. It's a good thing Carrie's dead, because that funeral would have sent him over the edge, Henry said. After the church service, we'd decided to skip the formal luncheon and had gone to a diner. Wind Beneath My Wings? Adam asked, absentmindedly taking my hand into his and blowing on it, which is what he did to warm my perpetually cold fingers. What's wrong with Amazing Grace? It's still traditional.
But doesn't make you want to puke,
Henry interjected.
Or better yet, Three Little Birds by Bob Marley. That would have been a more Carrie-worthy song. Something to toast the guy he was.
That funeral wasn't about celebrating Carrie's life, Mom growled, yanking at her scarf. It was about repudiating it. It was like they killed him all over again.
Dad put a calming hand over Mom's clenched fist.
Now come on, it was just a song.
It wasn't just a song, Mom said, snatching her hand away. It was what it represented. That whole charade back there. You, of all people, should understand.
Dad shrugged and smiled sadly. Maybe I should, but I can't be angry with his family. I imagine this funeral was their way of reclaiming their son.
Please, Mom said, shaking her head. If they wanted to claim their son, why didn't they respect the life he chose to live? How come they never came to visit or supported his music?
We don't know what they thought about all that, Dad replied. Let's not judge too harshly. It has to be heartbreaking to bury your child.
I can't believe you're making excuses for them, Mom exclaimed.
I'm not. I just think you might be reading too much into a musical selection.
And I think you're confusing being empathetic with being a pushover.
Dad's wince was barely visible, but it was enough to make Adam squeeze my hand and Henry and Willow exchange a look. Henry jumped in to Dad's rescue, I think.
It's different for you with your parents, he told Dad. I mean, they're old-fashioned, but they always were into what you did. And even in your wildest days, you were always a good son, a good father, always home for Sunday dinner.
Mom guffawed, as if Henry's statement had proven her point. We all turned to her, and our shocked expressions seemed to snap her out of her rant. Clearly, I'm just emotional right now, she said. Dad seemed to understand that was as much an apology as he was going to get right now. He covered her hand with his, and this time she didn't snatch it away. Dad paused, hesitating before speaking.
I just think that funerals are a lot like death itself. You can have your wishes, your plans, but at the end of the day, it's out of your control.
No way, Henry said. Not if you make your wishes known to the right people.
He turned to Willow and spoke to the bump in her belly.
So listen up, family. At my funeral, no one is allowed to wear black. And for music, I want something poppy and old school, like Mr. T Experience.
He looked up at Willow.
Got that?
Mr. T Experience. I'll make sure of it.
Thanks. And what about you, honey?
He asked her. Without missing a beat, Willow said, Play P.S. You Rock My World by the Eels. And I want one of those green funerals where they bury you in the ground under a tree, so the funeral itself would be in nature. And no flowers. I mean, give me all the peonies you want when I'm alive, but once I'm dead, better to give donations on my behalf to a good charity, like Doctors Without Borders.
You've got all the details figured out, Adam said. Is that a nurse thing?
Willow shrugged.
According to Kim, that means you're deep, I said. She says that the world is divided into the people who imagine their own funerals and the people who don't, and that smart and artistic people naturally fall into the former category.
So which are you? Adam asked me.
I'd want Mozart's Requiem, I said. I turned to Mom and Dad. Don't worry, I'm not suicidal or anything.
Please, Mom said, her mood lightening as she stirred her coffee. When I was growing up, I'd have elaborate fantasies about my funeral. My deadbeat father and all the friends who'd wronged me would weep over my casket, which would be red, naturally, and they'd play James Taylor.
Let me guess, Willow said. Fire and Rain?
Mom nodded, and she and Willow started laughing, and soon everyone at the table was cracking up so hard that tears ran down our faces. And then we were crying, even me, who didn't know Carrie all that well. Crying and laughing, laughing and crying.
So what now? Adam asked Mom when we'd calmed down. Still harbor a soft spot for Mr. Taylor?
Mom stopped and blinked hard, which is what she does when she's thinking about something. Then she reached over to stroke Dad's cheek, a rare demonstration of PDA.
In my ideal scenario, my big-hearted pushover husband and I die quickly and simultaneously when we're 92 years old. I'm not sure how. Maybe we're on a safari in Africa, because in the future we're rich. Hey, it's my fantasy. And we come down with some exotic sickness and go to sleep one night feeling fine and then never wake up. And no James Taylor. Mia plays at our funeral. If, that is, we can tear her away from the New York Philharmonic. Dad was wrong. It's true you might not get to control your funeral, but sometimes you do get to choose your death. And I can't help thinking that part of Mom's wish did come true. She went with Dad. But I won't be playing at her funeral. It's possible that her funeral will also be mine. There's something comforting in that. To go down as a family, no one left behind. That said, I can't help thinking Mom would not be happy about this. In fact, Mama Bear would be absolutely furious with the way events are unfolding today. 2:48 a.m. I'm back where I started, back in the ICU. My body, that is. I've been sitting here all along, too tired to move. I wish I could go to sleep. I wish there was some kind of anesthesia for me, or at least something to make the world shut up. I want to be like my body, quiet and lifeless, putty in someone else's hands. I don't have the energy for this decision. I don't want this anymore. I say it out loud. I don't want this. I look around the ICU, feeling kind of ridiculous. I doubt all the other messed up people in the ward are exactly thrilled to be here either. My body wasn't gone from the ICU for too long. A few hours for surgery, sometime in the recovery room. I don't know exactly what's happened to me, and for the first time today, I don't really care. I shouldn't have to care. I shouldn't have to work this hard. I realize now that dying is easy. Living is hard. I'm back on the ventilator, and once again there's tape over my eyes. I still don't understand the tape. Are the doctors afraid that I'll wake up mid-surgery and be horrified by the scalpels or blood? As if those things could faze me now. Two nurses, the one assigned to me and Nurse Ramirez, come over to my bed and check all my monitors. They call out a chorus of numbers that are as familiar to me now as my own name. BP, pulse ox, respiratory rate. Nurse Ramirez looks like an entirely different person from the one who arrived here yesterday afternoon. The makeup has all rubbed off and her hair is flat. She looks like she could sleep standing up. Her shift must be over soon. I'll miss her, but I'm glad she'll be able to get away from me, from this place. I'd like to get away, too. I think I will. I think it's just a matter of time, of figuring out how to let go. I haven't been back in my bed 15 minutes when Willow shows up. She marches through the double doors and goes to speak to the one nurse behind the desk. I don't hear what she says, but I hear her tone. It's polite, soft-spoken, but leaving no room for questions. When she leaves the room a few minutes later, there's a change in the air. Willow's in charge now. The grumpy nurse at first looks pissed off, like, "Who is this woman to tell me what to do?" But then she seems to resign, to throw her hands up in surrender. It's been a crazy night. The shift is almost over. Why bother? Soon, me and all of my noisy, pushy visitors will be somebody else's problem. 5 minutes later, Willow is back, bringing Gran and Gramps with her. Willow has worked all day, and now she is here all night. I know she doesn't get enough sleep on a good day. I used to hear Mom give her tips for getting the baby to sleep through the night. I'm not sure who looks worse, me or Gramps. His cheeks are sallow, his skin looks gray and papery, and his eyes are bloodshot. Gran, on the other hand, looks just like Gran. No sign of wear and tear on her. It's like exhaustion wouldn't dare mess with her. She bustles right over to my bed. "You've sure got us on a roller coaster ride today," Gran says lightly. "Your mom always said she couldn't believe what an easy girl you were, and I remember telling her, 'Just wait until she hits puberty.' But you proved me wrong. Even then, you were such a breeze. Never gave us any trouble.
never the kind of girl to make my heart race in fear. You made up for a lifetime of that today.
Now, now, Gramps says, putting a hand on her shoulder.
Oh, I'm only kidding. Mia would appreciate it. She's got a sense of humor, no matter how serious she sometimes seems. A wicked sense of humor, this one.
The chair up next to my bed and starts combing through my hair with her fingers. Someone has rinsed it out, so while it's not exactly clean, it's not caked with blood either. Gran starts untangling my bangs, which are about chin length. I'm forever cutting bangs, then growing them. It's about as radical a makeover as I can give myself. She works her way down, pulling the hair out from under the pillow so it streams down my chest, hiding some of the lines and tubes connected to me.
There, much better, she says. You know, I went outside for a walk today, and you'll never guess what I saw. A crossbill. In Portland in February. Now that's unusual.
I think it's Glow. She always had a soft spot for you. Said you reminded her of your father, and she adored him. When he cut his first crazy mohawk hairdo, she practically threw him a party. She loved that he was rebellious, so different. Little did she know your father couldn't stand her. She came to visit us once when your dad was around 5 or 6 and had this ratty mink coat with her. This was before she got all into the animal rights and crystals and the like. The coat smelled terrible, like mothballs, like the old linens we kept in a trunk in the attic. And your father took to calling her Auntie Trunk Smell. She never knew that, but she loved that he rebelled against us, or so she thought. And she thought it was something that you rebelled all over again by becoming a classical musician. Though much as I tried to tell her that it wasn't the way it was, she didn't care. She had her own ideas about things. I suppose we all do.
Gran twitters on for another 5 minutes, filling me in on more mundane news. Heather has decided she wants to become a librarian. My cousin Matthew bought a motorcycle, and my Aunt Patricia is not pleased about that. I've heard her keep up a running stream of commentary like this for hours while she's cooking dinner or potting orchids. And listening to her now, I can almost picture us in her greenhouse, where even in winter, the air is always warm and humid and smells musty and earthy, like soil with the slightest tinge of manure. Gran hand-collects cow shit. Cow patties, she calls them, and mixes them in with mulch to make her own fertilizer. Gramps thinks she should patent the recipe and sell it because she uses it on her orchids, which are always winning awards. I try to meditate on the sound of Gran's voice, to be carried away by her happy babble. Sometimes I can almost fall asleep while sitting on the bar stool at her kitchen counter and listening to her, and I wonder if I could do that here today. Sleep would be so welcome. A warm blanket of black to erase everything else. Sleep without dreams. I've heard people talk about the sleep of the dead. Is that what death would feel like? The nicest, warmest, heaviest, never-ending nap. If that's what it's like, I wouldn't mind. If that's what dying is like, I wouldn't mind that at all. I jerk myself up. A panic destroying whatever calm listening to Gran had offered. I am still not entirely clear on the particulars here, but I do know that once I fully commit to going, I'll go. But I'm not ready. Not yet. I don't know why, but I'm not. And I'm a little scared that if I accidentally think, I wouldn't mind an endless nap, it will happen and be irreversible. Like the way my grandparents used to warn me that if I made a funny face as the clock struck noon, it would remain like that forever. I wonder if every dying person gets to decide whether they stay or go. It seems unlikely. After all, this hospital is full of people having poisonous chemicals pumped into their veins or submitting to horrible operations all so they can stay, but some of them will die anyway. Did Mom and Dad decide? It hardly seems like there would have been time for them to make such a momentous decision,
and I can't imagine them choosing to leave me behind. And what about Teddy? Did he want to go with Mom and Dad? Did he know that I was still here? Even if he did, I wouldn't blame him for choosing to go without me. He's little. He was probably scared. I suddenly picture him alone and frightened, and for the first time in my life, I hope that Gran is right about the angels. I pray they were all too busy comforting Teddy to worry about me. Why can't someone else decide this for me? Why can't I get a death proxy? Or do what baseball teams do when it's late in the game and they need a solid batter to bring the guys on base home? Can't I have a pinch hitter to take me home? Gran is gone. Willow is gone. The ICU is tranquil. I close my eyes. When I open them again, Gramps is there. He's crying. He's not making any noise, but tears are cascading down his cheeks, wetting his entire face. I've never seen anyone cry like this. Quiet, but gushing. A faucet behind his eyes mysteriously turned on. The tears fall onto my blanket, onto my freshly combed hair. Plink, plink, plink. Gramps doesn't wipe his face or blow his nose. He just lets the tears fall where they may. And when the well of grief is momentarily dry, he steps forward and kisses me on the forehead. He looks like he's about to leave, but then he doubles back to my bedside, bends so his face is level with my ear, and whispers into it. "It's okay," he tells me. "If you want to go, everyone wants you to stay. I want you to stay more than I've ever wanted anything in my life." His voice cracks with emotion. He stops, clears his throat, takes a breath, and continues. "But that's what I want, and I could see why it might not be what you want. So I just wanted to tell you that I understand if you go. It's okay if you have to leave us. It's okay if you want to stop fighting." For the first time since I realized that Teddy was gone, too, I feel something unclench. I feel myself breathe. I know that Gramps can't be that late-inning pinch hitter I'd hoped for. He won't unplug my breathing tube or overdose me with morphine or anything like that. But this is the first time today that anyone has acknowledged what I have lost. I know that the social worker warned Gran and Gramps not to upset me, but Gramps' recognition and the permission he just offered me, it feels like a gift. Gramps doesn't leave me. He slumps back into the chair. It's quiet now. So quiet that you can almost hear other people's dreams. So quiet that you can almost hear me tell Gramps, "Thank you." When Mom had Teddy, Dad was still playing drums in the same band he'd been in since college. They'd released a couple of CDs. They'd gone on a tour every summer. The band was by no means big, but they had a following in the Northwest and in various college towns between here and Chicago. And, weirdly, they had a bunch of fans in Japan. The band was always getting letters from Japanese teenagers begging them to come play and offering up their homes as crash pads. Dad was always saying that if they went, he'd take me and Mom. Mom and I even learned a few words of Japanese just in case. Konnichiwa, arigatou. It never panned out, though. After Mom announced she was pregnant with Teddy, the first sign that changes were afoot was when Dad went and got himself a learner's permit at age 33. He tried letting Mom teach him to drive, but she was too impatient, he said. Dad was too sensitive to criticism, Mom said. So Gramps took Dad out on the empty country lanes in his pickup truck, just like he'd done with the rest of Dad's siblings, except they'd all learned to drive when they were 16. Next up was the wardrobe change, but it wasn't something any of us noticed right away. It wasn't like one day he stripped off the tight black jeans and band tees in exchange for suits. It was more subtle. First, the band tees went out the window in favor of button-up 1950s rayon numbers, which he dug up at the Goodwill until they started getting trendy, and then he had to buy them from the fancy vintage clothing shop.
Then the jeans went in the bin, except for one pair of impeccable dark blue Levi's, which Dad ironed and wore on weekends. Most days he wore neat, flat-front cuffed trousers. But when, a few weeks after Teddy was born, Dad gave away his leather jacket, his prized beat-up motorcycle jacket with a fuzzy leopard belt, we finally realized that a major transformation was underway.
"Dude, you cannot be serious," Henry said when Dad handed him the jacket. "You've been wearing this thing since you were a kid. It even smells like you."
Dad shrugged, ending the conversation. Then he went to pick up Teddy, who was squalling from his bassinet. A few months later, Dad announced he was leaving the band. Mom told him not to do it for her sake. She said it was okay to keep playing as long as he didn't take off on month-long tours, leaving her alone with two kids. Dad said not to worry. He wasn't quitting for her. Dad's other bandmates took his decision in stride, but Henry was devastated. He tried to talk him out of it. Promised they'd only play in town, wouldn't have to tour, ever be gone overnight. "We can even start playing shows in suits. We'll look like the Rat Pack, do Sinatra covers. Come on, man," Henry reasoned. When Dad refused to reconsider, he and Henry had a huge blowout. Henry was furious with Dad for unilaterally quitting the band, especially since Mom had said he could still play shows. Dad told Henry that he was sorry, but he'd made his decision. By this time, he'd already filled out his applications for grad school. He was going to be a teacher now. No more dicking around.
"One day you'll understand," Dad told Henry.
"The fuck I will," Henry shot back. Henry didn't speak to Dad for a few months after that. Willow would drop by from time to time to play peacemaker. She'd explain to Dad that Henry was just sorting some stuff out. "Give him time," she said, and Dad would pretend not to be hurt. Then she and Mom would drink coffee in the kitchen and exchange knowing smiles that seemed to say, "Men are such boys." Henry eventually resurfaced, but he didn't apologize to Dad. Not right away, anyhow. Years later, shortly after his daughter was born, Henry called our house one night in tears.
"I get it now,"
he told Dad. Strangely enough, in some ways, Gramps seemed as upset with Dad's metamorphosis as Henry had been. You would have thought he would love the new dad. On the surface, he and Gran seem so old school. It's like a time warp. They don't use computers or watch cable TV, and they never curse, and have this thing about them that makes you want to be polite. Mom, who swore like a prison guard, never cursed around Gran and Gramps. It was like no one wanted to disappoint them. Gran got a kick out of Dad's stylistic transformation. "Had I known all that stuff was going to come back in style, I would have saved Gramps' old suits," Gran said one Sunday afternoon when we'd stopped by for lunch, and Dad pulled off a trench coat to reveal a pair of wool gabardine trousers and a 1950s cardigan. "It hasn't come back into style. Punk has come into style, so I think this is your son's way of rebelling all over again," Mom said with a smirk. "Whose daddy's a rebel? Is your daddy a rebel?" Mom baby-talked as Teddy gurgled in delight. "Well, he sure does look dapper," Gram said. "Don't you think?" she said, turning to Gramps. Gramps shrugged.
"He always looks good to me. All my children and grandchildren do."
But he looked pained as he said it. Later that afternoon, I went outside with Gramps to help him collect firewood. He needed to split some more logs, so I watched him take an axe to a bunch of dried alder. "Gramps, don't you like Dad's new clothes?" I asked. Gramps halted the axe in midair. Then he set it down gently next to the bench I was sitting on.
"I like his clothes just fine, Mia," he said.
"But you looked so sad in there when Gran was talking about it." Gramps shook his head.
"Don't miss a thing, do you? Even at 10 years old."
"It's not easy to miss. When you feel sad, you look sad."
"I'm not sad. Your father seems happy, and I think he'll make a good teacher. Those are some lucky kids who get to read The Great Gatsby with your dad. I'll just miss the music."
"Music? You never go to Dad's shows."
"I've got bad ears from the war. The noise hurts."
"You should wear headphones. Mom makes me do that. Earplugs just fall out."
Maybe I'll try that. But I've always listened to your dad's music, at low volume. I'll admit I don't much care for all that electric guitar, not my cup of tea, but I still admire the music, the words especially. When he was about your age, your father used to come up with these great stories.